In the previous session, we talked about the genre of Genesis 1 through 3, and I presented my view that, well, Genesis 1 through 3 tells us an awful lot about God and his relationship with us, which is the heart of Old Testament theology, that it doesn't intend to tell us things like how God created creation or teach us cosmology. John Walton, I think, put it well that Genesis 1 through 3 is told from the perspective of the cognitive environment of the day, including the idea that there are three-tiered cosmology and so forth. And we shouldn't expect to find, modern cosmological ideas in the Bible. The Bible is written to communicate to its contemporary audience and to teach about God and his relationship with humanity. It's not there to teach us cosmology or science. Now, when the Bible does teach us about the world in a way that where we could determine it is intending to teach us, the Bible should always trump science. But we also have to remember that while religion can keep science from idolatry, so science can help us refine our understanding of the Bible. And that's certainly what happened during the Galileo period, where the church was insisting that for the Bible to be true, the earth had to be the center of the solar system. Now very few people would hold that view. Now, granted, there's no question but that the issue that we're talking about now is serious in terms of how it affects our theological thinking than the Galileo moment. But again, what I want to do now in this session, though I keep finding myself tempted to talk more about that very controversial issue, is now look at Genesis 1 through 3 in terms of what it does teach us about our relationship with God and who God is. Now, it's so rich, we can only touch the surface of it. But let's remember that in these chapters, we get our first introduction to who God is. And let's not forget either that Genesis 1 through 3 is written within a broader ancient Near Eastern context. And the picture of God here, the picture of the true God that we get here, is so radically different from any other ancient Near Eastern conception of deity. I mean, it's just utterly amazing. And I'll try to point that out. Okay, so what do we learn about God from these chapters? Well, first of all, we learn that he is the creator of everything. So in the first verses, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. God created everything. Heavens and earth encompass, everything that there is. Now, the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Now, it's interesting, and the early church fathers struggled with this, why there's a process at all in creation. I mean, today we debate over whether it happened in six literal 24-hour days or whether the 6 days represent long periods of time, and so forth and so on. But to the early church fathers, what was troubling was that it would even take 6 days, Augustine believed that we have here a figurative description of creation. 6 days that creation literally took place in a millisecond, you know. And but it is interesting that even literally understood, Genesis 1 talks about a process of creation. And here it moves from nothing to formless matter. And here in verse 2, when it says, "Now the earth was formless and empty, darkness was over the surface of the deep," we're to picture this as a big watery mass of unformed matter that now over 6 days God is going to make functional. He's going to organize it so it's habitable. And it's the I think one of the pictures this evokes in my mind is God as a sculptor or potter, an artist exerting energy toward this unformed matter in order to create something that is organized. And in the previous session, I talked about how the description of the days has this pattern that's sometimes called the framework hypothesis, where the first 3 days are talking about the creation of realms that are filled by the inhabitants of the second 3 days, so that day 4 fills day 1, day 5 fills day 2, day 6 fills day 3. But what do we learn about God here in this depiction of creation? We learn that He is one, for one thing. Again, remember, in the context of the ancient Near East, this is a radical, radical idea, where there are all the other systems of religion in the ancient Near East are polytheistic systems. That creation takes place not by the power of divine word, but rather by divine conflict. If you read, whether it's the Babylonian creation myths or the Canaanite myths, creation takes place as a result of the conflict between the creator God and the god of the sea. And interestingly, in later poetic descriptions of creation, like Psalm 74, you do get poetic descriptions of God's creation as a conflict with the sea, most notably with the sea monster Leviathan in a place like Psalm 74. But here in the opening chapters of Genesis, there is no need for divine conflict because there's no one for God to have conflict with. And so God, the one God, creates all of creation, not as a result of conflict, but through the power of His word. And this God is both transcendent, that is, He's other than creation. He looks at creation that He created and pronounces it good. So this is not a pantheistic view of creation. God is not a part of creation. He is not creation itself. That's what pantheism is. But He's transcendent. He's other. But also in Genesis 1 through 3, we learn that that this is not a deistic God either. He doesn't create creation and then withdraw from it. The divine watchmaker kind of religion, but rather He is immanent in it. He is involved in His creation. So these opening chapters depict God as transcendent and immanent. Biblical religion is theistic, not deistic or pantheistic. So Genesis 1 also teaches us that human beings are the apex of His creation. This is not to demean the rest of God's creation. It's not to give an excuse for the exploitation of creation. But on the other hand, there's no doubt about the fact that human beings are the apex of creation. That's communicated by the fact that they're created last on the sixth day after everything's prepared for them. It's communicated by the fact that human beings are created in the image of God, which we've already talked about, means that human beings, distinct from other parts of God's creation, reflect who God is. It's communicated by the fact that when the creation of human beings is described, the special verb bara is used, as opposed to the more generic term for making or creating, asah, is used. So there are lots of signals in Genesis 1, not to speak of in Genesis 2, the so-called second creation account, that also communicate humanity's special position within God's created order. Adam is created, yes, from the dust of the ground. We're part of creation, but also from the breath of God. We have a special relationship with him. So we learn, as I say, a lot about who God is, and we learn a lot about who we are and our relationship with him. We learn that gender and sexuality are a part of the creation, but not a part of the creator. In a place like Genesis 1:27, where it says that God created humanity in his image, both male and female. So, of course, unlike ancient Near Eastern religion, where there are male gods and female goddesses, and that these gods and goddesses have sex and they have children, there's nothing like that in biblical religion that would lead to the kind of fertility religions that you would find in Canaan and elsewhere. But rather, both gender and sexual activity are a part of creation, not a part of the creator. We also learn that God created human beings in an innocent, that they were innocent, that they aren't inherently evil. And Genesis 3 tells us that the evil that we experience in each other and in other people are a result of our human rebellion. And the frustration that we experience in our lives today isn't because God created the world in a distorted fashion, but rather because human sin affected creation itself. So there's a tremendous amount that we learn about, as I said, God and ourselves and our relationship with God. One more thing of the many things I could emphasize is the fact that God is vitally interested in relationship with his human creatures. I mean, theologians rightly defend the idea that, you know, God doesn't need human beings. There's a doctrine called the aseity of God, which means that God is whole in and of himself, that, and especially as we read about God through Scripture into the New Testament and learn more about the nature of the Trinity, that God, the Godhead itself, is relationally sufficient in of itself. God does not need creation. But you can't read the Bible, even these opening chapters, without coming away with the feeling that though God doesn't need creation, he certainly desires it, and he certainly pursues it with us, even after the fall. So these are just a few comments that we can make about Genesis 1 and 3 and its theological teaching. I always feel so inadequate offering just a few words about such a rich portion of Scripture. But even so, I mean, this is part of the problem, if I may just mention it one more time, of getting sidetracked on the how did God create creation. And I'm guilty of that too, in the sense that in the present context, we do need to discuss that issue. But I want to underline the fact that my main burden is not to convince people that evolution is right. That's really not my interest, but it is my interest to create room within our evangelical worldview that we recognize that Genesis 1 through 3 isn't addressing the question of how to. So we could discuss that and debate that as brothers and sisters and not cut each other off. Because, you know, my own view is if for some reason 10, 50, 100, 200 years from now, scientists say, well, you know, evolution, that's so passe. It won't affect my understanding of Genesis 1 through 3. Because Genesis 1 through 3 doesn't teach evolution. It doesn't teach how God did it. So let's put our focus more on what does it teach. That's my passion.